Welcome to the Charlotte Readers Podcast, where books and writing topics are center stage and where authors give voice to the written words. I'm Landis Wade, and on behalf of my co-host, Hannah LaRue and Sarah Archer, we thank you for listening.
The Charlotte Readers Podcast is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. Listen to your city at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
Hey listeners, this is Sarah Archer. Before we get started with today's show, I have a quick word. Charlotte Readers Podcast now has podcast books. It's true, we have two kinds, fiction and nonfiction. Our fiction book is titled Death by Podcasting, co-written by Landis and me. It's a comedic mystery where we make fun of podcasters and writers in the vein of Only Murders in the Building. It was a lot of fun to write, and it's available in paperback, ebook, and audiobook. We also have 8 nonfiction quote books created from over 500 podcast interviews. The Write Quote series is a collection of inspirational and practical quotes about writing, publishing, and book marketing from the first 4 years of the podcast. The books come with forewords and reflections by Hannah, Landis, and me. They're available in paperback and ebook, and here's a bonus. The first ebook in the series, about the writing life, can be downloaded for free. You can find links for all 9 books at the podcast books page of charlottereaderspodcast.com. Thank you for listening, and if you read our books, thanks for reading. Now let's get on with the show.
All right. Hey, guys, we are back for episode 389 of Charlotte Readers Podcast. We're getting up there. We're getting close to 400 right now. It's crazy. I'm super excited about the conversation I'm having today with Jerry Wilson, who has turned into a good friend of mine. She's an author that I am fortunate enough to work with on the publicity side. So I'm really thrilled to be able to have her on and talk with her about her new novel, That Pinson Girl. You know, it's a story that takes place in Mississippi during World War I. However, there's so many aspects of the story that are relevant to today's world. So I'm excited to kind of dive into all of that. Some praise for the novel, Clifford Garstang. Is that right, Jerry? Garstang, who is the author of Oliver's Travels and the Shaman of Turtle Valley, says that it's a devastating and beautifully written. Jerry Wilson's That Pinson Girl is at once a heart-rending tragedy and a testament to the indomitable human spirit. And I wanted to share that because I think the idea and the concept of what the human spirit is capable of is something you really kind of feel a lot throughout this book. So I'm excited to talk about everything and all of the things revolving around the book, but let's go ahead and talk about you for a little bit, Jerry. How's it going? Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Hannah. I'm really thrilled to be here.
I'm thrilled too. And so, you know, there's so much I was telling Jerry before we hopped on. I'm like, we'll talk about your background a little bit, which is kind of my favorite part. I mean, I love all of these conversations are always so much fun for me, but I love kind of hearing about the author's background. So you are a 7th generation Mississippian, right? So you kind of know the ins and outs of the state.
I am. And actually, I've gone back and I've double checked that on my ancestry account, because it sounds that's really going a long way back. And that's just on one side of my family. But on both sides of my family, folks came here very early on, like in the early around the middle of the 19th century. And so my roots here go way back. I grew up in the hills of North Mississippi, and that's the setting for the novel. It was just a natural setting for me to gravitate to, even though I haven't lived there in such a long, long time. I feel like the hills really shaped me and shaped who I am early on. And it doesn't hurt that that's Faulkner country, too.
yeah.
I love the Red Clay Hills.
Beautiful. Did you make your way back there at all while you were writing this book?
Well, because I was writing the book over about a 10-year period, I was back mm-hmm. there a time or two, and I've done a good bit of genealogy work. I've gone back and worked in the little library in Pontotoc is the name of my hometown. It's an Indian name. So I've done some genealogy work and visited the kind of cemeteries out in the country that I describe in That Pinson Girl as a cemetery set on top of a hill so that the weather doesn't affect it terribly much, but it makes it really hard to access. So yeah, I've been back a little bit, but I have very little family left there anymore. I will take that pension girl back though.
Yeah, and I think that'll be a beautiful kind of homecoming to be able to bring this novel back there with you. I kind of want to know just a little bit more about like the state of Mississippi, just as far as how it's changed over the years that you've been able to kind of experience and observe. How has it sort of stayed the same, and what are a few things that have changed?
Well, it's easier to say what's stayed the same than it is to say what's changed. We did change the state flag a couple of years ago. We finally managed to get rid of the Confederate symbolism on the flag. So that was good. And, you know, I wish people knew more about Mississippi than the stereotypes, because, Mississippi has a lot of really good people. Mississippi is very strong in the arts. You may not know this, but we host the International Ballet Competition here in Jackson every 4 years.
Wow. Okay.
And we have for at least 20 years now, maybe longer. So there's a very strong art scene. And most of your listeners will probably know that Mississippi has a strong literary scene, too. The authors that we could name, the great classic authors that come to mind, of course, are William Faulkner, Eudora Welty, but then there's so many others, and there's a new younger generation of writers like Jessamyn Ward, Angie Thomas. I could name a bunch. So that's a really positive thing about the state. It seems to me that so much of the artistic side of Mississippi comes out of the fact that we're such a complicated place. We deal with issues still of racism and poverty and class and women's rights. That may be a little more pronounced and in the spotlight here than they are in other places. But I think that lends itself to story. I think stories are how we make sense of things sometimes when we can't make sense of them in a real world way.
I think that's a really interesting concept, and it's something I've been thinking about a lot, just as I love to read, of course. I love movies, and there's so many great films that have come out over the last year that kind of give really high quality and digestible messages about what's going on in the world now, what's happened in the past, and how history seems to repeat itself a lot of the time. You know, I think you're right. Story is the way you kind of make more difficult conversations more digestible. I guess having said that, for you, over the course of, I know you just mentioned it took you 10 years to write this book. Did you kind of know at the beginning what sort of messages you wanted to, what kind of story or what was the big takeaway that you kind of wanted to come with this story, with that Pinson girl? Like, what did you want readers to walk away thinking about most?
Well, I think that changed over time as the book developed. I'm afraid the book in the beginning was more cliched. I had to break out of the mold of how I thought I might portray Luther Biggs, for instance, who's a biracial sharecropper who works for the Pinson family in this novel. But I always wanted readers to take away a sense of Leona, the main character's resilience. And even though she lived in a time when she was not someone who had any power to speak of, her world was extremely limited. And then when she had a child out of wedlock, Of course, that limited her world even more. So I always wanted readers to come away with a sense of her strength and her ability to overcome, which is a contemporary issue as much as it is a historical story, I hope, I think.
Oh, absolutely. So can you give us, I think that's a good segue into just kind of taking a deep dive into the book as a whole. Can you give us kind of your thumbnail sketch of the synopsis of the story?
Well, we can try to do that.
Yeah.
Leona Penson is 17 years old when she gives birth to an illegitimate child. She refuses to name the father. And in that day, we're talking 1918, having a child like that automatically excluded you pretty much from society. She's rejected by her family. She's certainly rejected by the community. But Leona hopes that the young man, who's the father of the child, will come back from the war. He's been shipped off to France. And she hangs on to the hope that he'll come back and he'll marry her. When he doesn't do that, it really changes the complexion of things. Leona also, she lives with her mother and her brother, who's sort of a, I'll use the word dastardly. That's a great old-fashioned word to use for Raymond Penson, because he is dangerous for Leona. He's abusive. He's cruel. And not just to Leona. He rides with a group of men who go out at night and burn people's barns, particularly the black folks who live around that area. And he's just really up to no good. She has an aunt who lives with them, who is Sally is a little person, a dwarf, which would have been the term that was used back then, who has come to live with them after Leona's father dies. And so you have this complex of people, of families that are knit together in spite of their genetic relationship. They come together in one way or another. The story is told against the backdrop of the deprivation of World War I, and there's also the influenza epidemic. And it's a story of generations of betrayal, really. I hope, although it's an historical novel, I hope that it still resonates with contemporary issues. Because racism and classism and sexism and poverty are still a part of our world, very much so.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's something that a lot of, readers will really kind of connect with a lot of these issues and just what they've observed in their own time. And something that really, like, it's super recent that'll probably pull on the heartstrings and the brain strings and all of the things is, like you were just talking about, the influenza epidemic and the Spanish flu pandemic. You know, it's like this whole that is such a brutal time, and then of course we're kind of still recovering from the COVID pandemic.
Yeah.
Was that something you kind of weaved into the story when COVID happened? Was that, or
no.
It was something that you'd already kind of been, okay.
No, it was always in the story. If you're going to write about that time period, it would have seemed awkward to me not to include that. And then it became more important in terms of what happens to the characters than I'd initially envisioned. But I have to bring my maternal grandmother into the conversation at some point, mm-hmm. because Leona is modeled so much on her. My grandmother didn't have a child out of wedlock, but she grew up very poor, had an eighth grade education, lived an extremely hard life, but she was such a resilient kind of stubborn person, to put it more bluntly. And she really had a zest for life, and she was really creative. She was a great storyteller. And one of her stories was that she nursed a neighbor family through the influenza and didn't get sick herself. And we always sort of marveled at that. And so Leona's experience with the flu is similar to that in the book.
Wow, that's really crazy to think about, you know? It's kind of like a magical thing, really. I love that that's sort of how you came to create Leona, because for all of you listening, Leona is one of those characters. I mean, and I just want to say, I don't know if you've read any of Kristen Hannah's books, The Four Winds, that Pinson girl really kind of had different stories, of course, but similar feeling while you're reading them, just sort of that sense of struggle to just make it, you know, you're not even really trying to do something astronomically crazy besides survive. And Leona is sort of just like the definition of a strong female protagonist. You know, you open up the story, the book with her experience giving birth. As I was reading that, you know, it's very, it's painful. It is something that you really kind of feel the strength that a woman has, especially during something like that. I think I'm thinking the words that you used were the baby tore its way into life, into the world. And that was kind of like that word, tearing your way into the world. You know, that was a very, I thought that was such a great line, and it kind of already speaks to the strength of Leona. So you sort of get a foreshadowing as for what kind of journey she's going to have ahead. So I kind of wanted to ask, just how did you decide to open up the book with that experience for her? And how was it for you writing about that?
Well, it's pivotal for her. I guess we'd have to say that her getting pregnant at all is the pivotal moment, because her life will never be the same after that. But it just seemed to me that the birth scene is bringing Leona into the world too, in a different way. It's changing her world. And that's a good question.
Yeah, and I think kind of in that same vein, the role of motherhood, or the theme of motherhood throughout the book. I mean, Leona doesn't have a particularly great relationship with her mother, I would say. How did you flesh that out? Like, how did you kind of flesh out the family tree, the Pinson family tree, and their relationships with each other?
Well, I knew those relationships had to be difficult. One of the things I had to deal with Leona, and some of that I think is due to the time frame, the time in which she lived, is that I had to try to avoid her being passive and things happening to Leona, because things do happen to Leona over and over again. But how does she resist? How does she survive? How does she press on? The family dynamic, I think, is a little close to home for me. My mother was not a difficult person, but she was a little bit distant, a little bit detached. And so there's that. I think what happens is that each of these characters is deeply troubled in his or her own way. And so that creates both boundaries and ties within relationships. It creates boundaries because people hold back. It creates ties because people cling to those closest to them. I have to say that Sally, the aunt, she was just a gift. She's not something that comes out of my family history, but except for the fact that I knew a woman when I was a little girl who waited tables in her brother's barbecue restaurant. And she was so small that she could barely reach the tabletops to put plates of food on the table. And I was always fascinated by her, even when I was growing up, I was fascinated by, I wondered what her life could possibly have been like. And then Leona needed a nemesis, and that's her brother, who has a difficult relationship with the father who's died. And Luther becomes a kind of, Luther Biggs, the sharecropper character, becomes a kind of father figure for Leona. Although she resists that relationship in some ways because she's been taught, she knows that it's inappropriate for her to care the law of a black man, even though he's old enough to be her father. She feels a little bit ashamed of that. And so it's just a matter of, most family relationships are complicated, right? In one way or another. And so I think in fiction, sometimes those complications need to be writ large in order to make them work.
Hey, listeners, Landis Wade here. Just want to jump in and share with you before we get back to the interview an elevator pitch that we have from one of our listener authors. This is something we do here on the podcast, as you know, where authors can call in and pitch their books, and it's fun to listen to those and hear about them. And I think this particular pitch here will fit very nicely with this episode. So let's listen in, and then after we're done with that, let's get back to the episode.
I am Vaughn Earl Justice. My memoir is Repercussions, My Sister's Story. When I was 7, my sister was 19 and away at her first year in college. Over 50 years later, I received a shocking phone call that the son she had given up for adoption wanted to meet his birth family. Was there a reason my sister never told me? What happened that would make her give up a son, and was that part of the reason her life turned out the way it did? That phone call started me on a search to find out everything I could about the sister I adored.
I'd love it if you have a reading to share with us.
I do have a little bit of a reading. Yeah, this comes about 40 pages into the book, and I need to give you just a little bit of context. Leona is going out in the car, in a car, with the boy that she's just sort of has a crush on. Walker Broom is his name, and he has asked her to go out for a drive in his car, and it just seems like a wondrous thing to Leona because her family doesn't own a car. But she's wary of having him come to her house, and so she asks him to meet her in a place called Hawks Creek, which is a place where they meet frequently after this. And so this little scene is about Walker picking her up in the car and taking her out into the countryside. Oh, and it mentions a little nearby town called Sully. So if you hear the word Sully, you'll know what that means. When Leona heard the car coming, she felt loose inside, as though only string held her together. The car came down the lane, bouncing over the ruts, and stopped. The engine sputtered and cackled like an old woman. "Get in," Walker shouted. "If I cut the motor, I'll have to crank it again." She climbed in the car, and he backed up, sped down the rutted lane, and swerved out onto Pinson Road, churning up dust. The car lurched along in fits and starts, not like the steady trot of a horse. Once she got used to the jostling and the noise, she enjoyed the rush of wind and the landscape passing by like a picture show. He drove towards Sully, but then he took a road Leona wasn't familiar with and drove far out into the country, where the hills grew steeper and the road narrowed. From Leona's house, these hills loomed beyond the ridge like a bank of blue-gray thunderclouds. When she was little, she had called them mountains. "Take me to the mountains," she used to ask her father, but he never did. The car's engine struggled to make the climb. On the crest of a hill, he pulled over and stopped where the road overlooked the valley. And there was Sully in the distance. It seemed the town could fit in the palm of her hand. She had never traveled farther than Luna, 15 miles past Sully. She had never had reason to come up into these hills, only a few miles west of her home, beyond the ridge, which was the highest place she knew. But she couldn't look out from the ridge and get a sense of the world. The forests were too dense, the clearings walled in by trees like little fortresses. Now, looking out towards Sully and beyond, the horizon stretched long and flat, not curved like she would have expected if she were to believe the earth is round as she'd been taught. If she could fly like a bird, could she see the curvature of the earth? But Leona could not fly, and her life so far was confined to the place where she was born, the old house, the land around it. She yearned for something larger.
What a beautiful selection for you to have picked, because I think that kind of encapsulates her character and the journey that she's on in this story, you know, just kind of dreaming. She's a dreamer for sure. And she's somebody that, you know, you're really rooting for her so much throughout this story. You're just like, Leona, you can do this. Like, you can live a happy, you can do anything, you know. I kind of want to circle back to the concept. You know, you talked a little bit about Luther, who is, he was one of my favorite parts of this book for sure. And like you mentioned, he's an older black man, a sharecropper. He, like his son Jesse, they're a big part of this and a big part of Leona's life. And she loves him. You know, that it does become kind of her father figure and the person she trusts, who kind of helps her through some of these darker moments. And I think it kind of opens up a conversation about how love kind of doesn't have any boundaries at all, and it kind of can cross over into, you know, race doesn't really play a role in this case. It doesn't, when it does in every other situation. So what are your thoughts on that? And just what did you want for that relationship in this story between Luther and Leona?
Well, I wanted Leona to break some boundaries. And she does that. Even though she feels a little bit ashamed of how much she cares for Luther, and she thinks it might be inappropriate. She reaches beyond that. Like when Luther is ill, she takes her child, Isaiah, and goes to stay with Luther and live in his house and nurse him back to health, which is something that just appalls her, her aunt and her brother particularly. So it's part of Leona, I think, discovering who she is, through reaching beyond those boundaries that otherwise would just keep her so isolated.
Mm-hmm. That's so powerful. Their relationship was one that I feel like you really learn a lot from, just what love means and kind of like how, you know, there's so many things that kind of throw themselves into a relationship. And in this case, it's the fact that he is a black man and he, you know, she's kind of grown up with in this sort of volatile white family that really don't have a whole, they're pretty rough around the edges, to say the least. And to find someone, or to be in the presence of someone like Luther, who has faced so much adversity and these traumatic experiences himself, it's probably something that you sort of realize you can bond with people about trauma.
Yeah.
Across boundaries, you know?
I think the same is true for Luther in so many ways, because Luther really cares for her. He's known her since she was an infant. And, it's complicated for Luther because he knows he has to, and I'll put this in air quotes, stay in his place, close quotes, in order to help Leona when he goes to the house when Leona's giving birth. And he takes some herbs with him that he knows his wife would have used. His wife was a midwife. But in order to influence Leona's aunt to use the herbs, he has to really, he's very hat in hand. He has to be very careful about how he approaches all that. And the aunt doesn't use the herbs until Liliana is bleeding and is a very crucial point for her in terms of her survival. But Luther has to walk a kind of narrow path too. And Luther's parentage is such that he doesn't really belong in either world. He doesn't mm-hmm. belong in the black world, and he certainly doesn't belong in the white world.
Yeah, I mean, he's such a beautifully complex character. I mean, they all really are in this story. And there was, I think that kind of brings me to Raymond, maybe the most... There, I mean, honestly, there were scenes with him in it in this book where you just sort of like, you know, they're hard to read, but of course important to read. And I'm kind of curious. I mean, there's even parts of the story where you feel a little bad for him. You sort of are like, oh, I empathize with him a little bit. But it's pretty easily thrown out the window in another page, you know. He's just pretty brutal. He's very violent. He's mean. He's scary. I'm kind of curious, how was that for you writing him? Was it a hard experience for you to kind of get into his head?
It was, but I sort of enjoyed writing Raymond. I'm not sure.
Why is that?
I'm not sure why that is. Well, yeah. You know, somebody has said that even the most... evil person has some shred of at least a hope of redemption. And so what you said about feeling maybe a little bit bad for Raymond at some points in the book is exactly what I was hoping people would see, because Raymond is sad. Raymond has longed for a relationship with his father that he was never able to have. How much of that is Raymond's fault? How much of that is the father's fault? You know, is something for the reader to come to grips with. Raymond feels left behind. He's the only male on the farm, and so he escapes being drafted to go to the war because of that. And he resents it highly. He wants to go to the war. He wants to be a different kind of man from the one he seems to be, and yet mm-hmm. he's confined to home.
So he's trapped.
He's trapped too, which I think every character in the book is trapped to one degree or another, and what differentiates them is whether they're able to break out of that trap or not.
I think, yeah, and I think that kind of brings us full circle to the quote that I shared at the beginning of this from Clifford, you know, talking about the human spirit and how a lot, like, you really, throughout this book, the human spirit really shines through. I mean, like we're saying, these characters are trapped and they're people who are all kind of trying to find their way, trying to survive, really, you know. And I think for you, was it something like, what is the human spirit capable of to you? Was that something you kind of explored throughout writing this?
Yeah, I think so. Actually, the working title for years and years was Spirit Lamp or Spirit Light.
Wow. I love that.
I did too. Actually.
That's so magical.
But the publisher did not. And so we had to change the title. But there's a little lamp in the book, in the novel, that Luther gives a little, it would have been called a spirit lamp back in those days. It was a little lamp, probably with a brass base and a little glass chimney that would have burned kerosene or something like that. And it was something that had belonged to Luther's mother. And he gives it to Leona when she's about, I think she's about 8 years old or so. And she cherishes that little lamp. And that lamp sees her through some some really hard times. And for me, and maybe the symbolism was too heavy-handed, maybe that was one of the objections to that as a title, but for me, that was Leona's light. Take it literally, take it figuratively. That became a symbol for me when I was writing of Leona's spirit. She might be trapped by the circumstances of her life, as was her mother, as was her aunt, as was Luther. But that light signals to me that she's going to go beyond that.
I love that so much. And this is just such a great book. And I hope all of you go and grab a copy of it. It's just something I loved reading it. And I know a lot of others have loved it so far and are going to continue to do that. I have one more question for you before we close this out. I wish we had like 8,000 hours. there's so many kind of topics and symbolism to dive into with this book, which is always so much fun for me. And I know for a lot of our listeners too. But, you know, this is your debut novel and you are 82 years old.
I absolutely am. Yeah.
You know, I think that is so cool and so inspiring. And I'm really curious as to sort of hearing the answer from you to this question, just about you'd been writing this book for about 10 years on and off, probably,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
How does it feel to kind of get it out into the world? And what would you tell someone else who maybe nearing 80 or 90 or 100, you know, if they're considering writing, what would you say to them?
Well, at 90, if they could still lift a pen, I would say, do it, you know, just do it. In whatever form it takes, if it's, and especially do it for your children, do it for your grandchildren. Get the stories down, whether they're true or whether they're fictional. I've been at this for a long time, but I started late. I was a late bloomer. I didn't start writing short fiction until I was about 50. But that still means I've been doing it for a long time. I had some illusions, I think, early on that held me back, and so I would encourage people to not feel constrained to some of the things you hear and read about what publishing has to be like. I'm really lucky to have landed with a strong independent press, a small press, and they've been wonderful to work with. I spent a lot of years thinking that if I didn't have an agent and I didn't land some kind of important publisher, then what I was doing was not worthwhile, and that's just not true. That's the right route for some people. It's not the right route for everybody. So take heart. Be proud of what you do. Seek out good readers, people who will read and be honest with you about what you're doing. But always, always trust your own instincts, because that's so important. I wish I had back the 2 years or so that I didn't write very much after I had a kind of unfortunate experience with an agent, and it just shut me down. And, of course I wouldn't be where I am now in this time frame if that hadn't happened. Mm-hmm. That was part of the journey for me, but, try to find the time to do it. Because it's important. It's really important.
What a great answer. I feel like out of, that's some of the best advice for writers I think I've heard definitely in a long time. Especially, I think it speaks to a lot of people on different levels, as far as it's really intimidating, you know, to kind of put yourself out there and have other people read what you're writing. And there is kind of this idea of what the publishing journey looks like or what it should look like. And it's not the same for everybody. So I think, that's so powerful. And I appreciate you sharing that and coming on and talking about your work. This has been such a great time for me, and I feel super fortunate to have been able to sit down virtually with one of my favorite authors. I think you're just so talented and wonderful. So thank you for being here, Jerry.
Thank you, Hannah. And I want to just adopt you as one of my granddaughters.
I mean, okay. Sign me up.
Sign you up. Yeah.
I'm there.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Fun.
Hey, folks, as we wrap up another episode, we just want to say thank you for listening. We appreciate you being here, and we hope you enjoyed the show. We also hope you'll join our community. To do that, feel free to poke around our website, charlottereaderspodcast.com. The best way to stay in touch is to sign up for our twice monthly newsletter, and you can do that via the contact page on the website. We won't spam you. That takes way too much time. We're not going to do that. You can also use our website to read our community blog and show notes, submit an elevator pitch to be played on the show, submit a blog post, give us feedback, submit to be on the show, become a Patreon supporter, and to see what's coming up on the show next, order our podcast books, or listen to previous episodes. So many things, and the best part, it's all free. Until the next episode, this is Hannah LaRue, and on behalf of Sarah Archer and Landis Wade, read on, write on, and rock on.